Hello everybody, this is Peter Smith and this is Aged Awareness number 5 in a series of essays. It's now Saturday the 8th of February 2020. The following is a short extract from Dwayne Hepner's book, The Real Far Country, Book 3, Scene 11, of his Amazing Romantic Adventures series. The real universal guide, Rebazar Tars, is speaking Dwayne. For ages, man has accepted the tradition of the existence of two worlds. The first is the world of appearances, and the other is the world of existences. Man has assumed that the knowledge of things link him to his being, and has always assumed that the appearances alone were something so accessible. Everything on the outer is therefore necessarily an appearance. In fact, reality can only be attained as the isness and never from without. Each person must turn their vision to themselves in order to begin the most marvellous of all explorations. Happiness can only come from us, only by entering into a sublime silence and closing our ears and eyes to the world of illusions. Can we hear the celestial melodies? Otherwise we are but yielding to delusions of the outer imagination, and can only reap a harvest of bitter misery. The outer imagination is maya, assumable illusion. The discovery of the real you is first of all an act of inward retirement. It is termed a going within and the penetration of the first step into the unseen worlds. We are now penetrating into an invisible world. This discovery occasions anguish, and it is presumptuous to march to the conquest of its inner world without the very definite directions, very precise counsels, hence the necessity of a real guide on the royal highway to a real life where the all is. Once we begin to catch on to subtleness of reality, the outward impressions withdraw and fade away. You soon experience the joy of a new life like never before, and not what the religions refer to, but a whole new vista of opportunities. Your life is no longer from an object outside or an enigma to be solved, but one of a serene confidence and a living consideration. It is your secret alone. This discovery, far from causing a sense of misery, becomes a source of wellness and light. After living so long in this world as a stranger, you learn to take refuge in your own solitude of exploration. You are now learning to perceive new worlds that will welcome you, and by, you obtain the direct perception of these superior levels. To understand real truth does not demand violence. It needs true reverence and a willingness to listen. Real truth will only reveal itself to those who seek it and love it. Real guidance is the first step, then the focusing on the true attributes of the all is, which can only be purity, humility, sincerity, and gratitude. The great training that takes place for each U-turn is for the sole purpose of eventually becoming a real guide with the great reality, the is. This new birth, in what the theologians term as the descent of the Holy Spirit ghost, but their terminology, or the real connection with the all is gone and no longer has any value or worth. But it does appeal to those that are of an intellectual nature and tends to follow some sort of lower authority of total control. Besides, theirs is the negative rays from the cow god and not the real light connection. The real illumination is united to an infinite love for what is real, the all is. This illuminated flame, this simultaneous love and knowledge, when born, rises and grows until finally, through a kind of personal ecstasy, our whole being is enkindled with a supreme desire to reach the seventh level and those worlds beyond it, up to the all is. We must first have the super knowledge to succeed. The written presentation is always the first step, and then an examination of real experiences the student is having while the body is put to rest, or what is taking place with the new you sessions. There must be a sort of agitation occurring as we continue on our endless journey. What I am referring to is nothing below our means, but of a sort of fueling ourselves to continue the real adventure life is. Pretty words and old wisdom from times gone by is more for those who are content with the earthly life of a human. This is why all that has been documented has been so successful in the business world, and those who have formed their own religious sects are wealthy from it. To the unaware, they do not look past the accomplishments of those in control, but bow to them instead. And it is really the fruits of those whose labour has made it all possible for others to walk on them. So a continuous comparison must be obtained for one to reach into the real universes and become established there. We are now beyond the elementary positions which have been established by historical figures the public looks to. If the reality of life is bigger than what is on the earth, then why would a person even consider what is taking place in a dark realm and a floating rock in space? There is always more than what is seen. We first call this the impersonal state of intuition, or our no-thought perception, as we perceive and no longer divide into a thinking subject in an external world only, but rather the outer world is slightly transformed by its integration into our own personal awareness. Our personal awareness is by no means nullified. We are not abolishing the little personality, but providing a true completeness of the personal self. The summit of the true reality can only be reached through this accepted position and a mode of comparison unlike anything the mind is used to. You cannot hope to possess other true riches than those we already bear with us. We should use them and not neglect them. Alas, they have been neglected for many eons, far past what we can ever conceive. So familiar, yet unnoticed, they no longer appear of any value, and most pursue other tawdry chattels whose position is denied. Most have become so weak that the world is sometimes obligated to rebuff them, and cause many to detach themselves from this world. The existence of the great reality is a true fact, and sooner or later all will ardently yearn for it. Those who approach this discovery realize they are among the select, and an extremely limited number. Up until recently, the Western world had never been granted the privilege of having the true revelations of the real universal guides given in the common universal language. Throughout history, the philosophical and religious teachings have been veiled and shrouded in mystery to purposely keep people ignorant of the vital knowledge of life. That is why such teachings were classified as esoteric, known only to a limited number of those who are ready to become more aware. The real universal guides are the real connection to the all is. A word from them is a word from the reality. They have no need to help others, for just being in their presence is elevating, inspiring, stirring and life-giving. Their company is self-satisfying, and living in their presence is a real education. All agonies, miseries, tribulations, taints of world illness and other things are negative aspects that seem to vanish in their mere presence, and one's doubts are removed. They can awaken the individual through sight, touch, the spoken word and thought. They can communicate real truth to their students as easily as one offers fruit to another. They are an ever-flowing fountainhead of the trueness of life. A thirsty student who has implicit trust in the true silent ones, the reality as the all is, and who is eager to imbibe the teachings and experiences of the real universal guides, can drink the divine nectar. The student who positions themselves with the real guides with an intense and adamant degree of trust and true sincerity will become immortal beyond their own imagination. We are the real presence in this new nowness. True realization can never be taught, but it must be caught in its own way. Once you have mastered the secrets of learning to identify what is real now from the real guides, you have been connected to the new sound wave, and then it is not necessary to have the constant physical association with them. Your realizationship from the real side of life will continue on anywhere and everywhere. There will be times when one or more of the real guides will appear within your unseen worlds, and so pay attention to the characterization that is displayed. The time has now come for mankind to accept the sound light reality in his life and for this time. Because of all the build-up from the past and all that human history has shown us, the present day undercurrent of emotion, thought, religion, philosophy, political control and scientific discovery have placed the populations of the world in a position of deterioration. The rulers of the unaware will continue to employ people into the same old routines of feeling safe with the same mistakes that have brought everything to where it is today. With the new presentation, so much of the nonsense that has been established in this world will be exposed and the people can decide for themselves. End of quotation. An examination of real experiences the student is having while the body is put to rest clearly refers to the dream state. Apparently, we all dream during certain periods of our sleep every night, but we seem to only occasionally remember our dreams or frustratingly short excerpts from them on awakening. What, therefore, one may ask, is the point of dreaming if you remember so little of it? I would suggest this argument could equally be applied to previous lifetimes. And as with previous lifetimes, it is possible to explore dreams or have them shown to you in some detail and thereby show there is very much a point to it. It has to be said, however, that it is probably easier to retrieve forgotten dreams than it is past lifetimes, but that ultimately depends on the dreams or past lives themselves. In the case of dreams, retrieval can be facilitated by singing the new you regularly. Eventually, you will start to remember more of your dreams, but in particular, the more meaningful ones. In my view, dreams, like so-called ghosts, come in various different types, and I think the meaningful dreams we are concerned with could be likened to interactive ghosts, that is, actual sentient beings from a different plane of existence, as against so-called residuals or visual playbacks of past events or other types of apparitions. Our meaningful dreams derive also from other planes of existence, that is the real side, basically any other level above the physical we are so familiar with and struggling to survive. The meanings of the meaningful dreams are inevitably couched in symbolic form and as such are messages direct from the real guides. These will start to become a regular event once the real guides become aware of your sincere attempts to contact them, and the best way of doing this is by the new you, as mentioned above. This is not to say that the real guides may not already be aware of you and your genuine desire to rise above the lower levels and onto the real universes, even before coming across Duane and or before him, Paul Twitchell, and their presentations. Indeed, logically, many advanced beings must have found their way back to the All Is, the ultimate goal of our journey, over past centuries without such assistance, even the real guides themselves. We are, however, extremely fortunate to be here at this time and to have Duane and his wonderful books, etc., to show us the way. For my own part, I strongly feel I already had some inkling, at the very least, about all this, and brought it with me from my last life on earth. It is for this reason I earnestly believe the real guides felt I might just be worth persevering with and relieved me of much of the karma I might otherwise have accrued. Certainly the meaningful dreams started at a very early age. At, I believe, somewhere around the age of 5 or 6, I started having a terrible recurrent nightmare, which I can recall vividly to this day, almost 70 years later. As an observer, slightly up in the air, I was looking at a row of terraced, two up, two down, old houses in a street that was clearly inspired by the one we lived in Luton for the first 17 years of my life. As with our street, there were small front gardens stretching probably little more than 10 feet out to the pavement, sidewalk that is in America. Our street has various different walls or low fences out front, whereas in the dream they all had a uniform white picket fence about 18 inches to 2 feet high, each with their own neat little gate opening out onto the pavement. From the start there was an atmosphere of menace, slowly growing in strength, as a frail, small figure of indeterminate sex worked its way along from front door to front door, and although the doors never opened, was apparently being turned away at each one. Then, as the feeling of foreboding became unbearable, a huge black billowing mass came in from the left side and engulfed everything. As it covered the figure, it suddenly seemed it was I who was being engulfed, even though I was watching it happen from outside, as it were. I've always believed this was some form of symbolic throwback to my last violent death. The pathetic creature being so pointedly rebuffed resonates strongly with somebody being shunned by former colleagues and supposed friends who no longer wished to be associated or linked with him in their own best interests. I had other occasional striking dreams from time to time that were so powerful in their effect I've remembered them ever since, but no other recurrent ones. One was certainly enough. On two occasions that I can remember, I had remarkable precognitive dreams. Both were, in essence, fairly trivial by their own nature, though stunning to me at the time. It seems unlikely to me, therefore, that they would be the work of the real guides, who I am sure would have more important things to spend their time on. Certainly I got more than my share of their incredible help on many far more meaningful matters at other times, but who am I to judge? The first dream, not necessarily in chronological order, as I do not remember exactly when this one occurred, though it had to be in the very early 1970s, concerned my first car, which I owned between 1968 and 1971. It was 1958 Morris Minor 1000, or Moggy, as they are affectionately known in the UK. Properly developed, it is said they could have been the UK's answer to the Volkswagen Beetle. Nevertheless, on this occasion, the clutcher decided to go. Conveniently for me at least, it decided to do this only a few hundred yards from our house, as I set off for work one morning and my old dad was at home, as this was the start of his annual holiday from work. I walked back and told him what had happened, and he went back with me and managed to get it in gear and run it back into our garage, whose door we had left open for the purpose. The dear man, always my greatest hero, then spent the next few days removing the gearbox and replacing the second gear, which had always been rough, and clutch. Luckily, motors were his meat, as he had spent most of his adult life as a fitter in the experimental department of the Comma truck plant in Luton, broken only by 6 years in the Royal Tank Corps during World War II, repairing broken down tanks on the battlefield, often under enemy fire. Once the old Moggy was back on the battlefield of Luton Roads, I desperately wanted to buy him a present for what he had done for me, but was at a loss to what to get him. Rather than the usual Christmas cigars, I wanted to get something more substantial and permanent. Then, in a dream, I saw the ideal thing, a big book about birds. "Of course," I exclaimed to myself on waking, "he loves our feathered friends. It's one of his many interests." Next day, in the lunch hour, remembering the only bookshop of note at that time in the neighbouring town of Dunstable, where I worked, I went up the fairly small side street concern, one I had not been up for a long time. It being a fairly tiny shop, evidently a converted two-up-two-down terraced house, it had only one tiny shop window. And there it was, prominent amongst a handful of books, vying to be seen in the window, a magnificent thick volume boasting a large picture of an owl practically winking at me on its cover, which turned out to be an encyclopedia of British birds, full of glorious colour photos of every one of our native species. My old dad was visibly moved when I gave it him, and said it really was something he had always wanted. The second precognitive dream I wished to relate happened, as far as I can now work out, probably in the early to mid-1970s. While based at our Dunstable office, due to their being very short-handed after two or three people had left, I was asked to spend odd days over at the head office in Luton to help out. One night I dreamed briefly of a boy who used to live down our road when we were kids and was a friend of mine. His name was Dave. Eventually his family moved away, I was probably about 10, and I never saw him again. Not, that is, until the very next day after my dream, many years later, by which time we were grown men. I was walking down from the Luton office towards the town, probably mentally miles away as usual, when a voice from the road shouted words to the effect of, "Hello Pete, how you doing? Can't stop, I'm late for work." I looked to the street to see Dave passing by on a moped and just had time to return the greeting. Had I not had the dream, I'm pretty certain I would not have realised in time who it was and been able to respond in time. Other people had precognitive dreams of great disasters like the Titanic and Aberfan, the Welsh mining community that lost a generation of children when a huge coal heap collapsed and engulfed, amongst other things, the village school, killing more than 140 children and adults. My such dreams concerned a book and a long-lost childhood pal. Still on reflection, I think I prefer mine. Going back to my earlier analogies with types of ghosts, these types of dream could be likened to the so-called anticipatory apparition. Perhaps a less familiar phenomenon than the others, there are certainly some cases studied by the London Society for Psychical Research, the SPR, over the years. One typical one concerned somebody upstairs at home hearing the front door going, followed by the sound of footsteps up the stairs. On opening the door to greet the visitor, there was nobody there. Then, a short while later, the sounds were repeated, and this time a visitor entered the door. I think the theory goes, in cases like this, that the visitor in this case must have been strongly anticipating their calling at the earlier time in question. However, that being so, you would think this would be happening all the time, so I find that a rather weak argument, having regard to the rarity of the phenomenon. The SPR, however, were, and I believe still are, meticulous in their study and investigation of so-called paranormal phenomena, so we cannot simply ignore them when they are reported. As a footnote here, writing about Aberfan reminds me of a recent TV programme in which the disaster figured, and the fact that in some ways it could be likened to my childhood nightmares, albeit only superficially. However, that disaster happened in 1966, I believe, certainly many years after my nightmares, and I cannot believe it was an extremely early precognitive dream. Such dreams, in any case, tended to be one-offs, not recurring. Besides, I had no personal involvement in Aberfan, whereas the feeling of personal involvement in the nightmare was paramount. On the subject of one-offs, which the vast majority of dreams, certainly mine, tend to be, one of several such that was so vivid and alarming it has stayed in my memory to this day is perhaps worth relating here. I really have no idea when this took place, but it was certainly many decades ago. It was a very fast-moving dream in which I was perched on the front of a Western-style stagecoach in the driving position, except there were no horses or indeed reins visible. The stagecoach was hurtling up a seemingly endless alley at breakneck speed, and I was clinging to it for dear life. It appeared to be night time. On either side of the alley, the walls were covered in posters and hoardings, but going past too fast to be able to read, even had I dared to take my eyes off the way ahead. Suddenly I saw a wall at the end of the alley looming up, also covered in posters, and the coach, with me still clinging to it, plunged into it. Immediately the scene changed, but all was still and calm. I was confronted, I believe the stagecoach had vanished, by a kind of Chinese willow pattern type setting. In the middle sat a plump mandarin type, complete with long drooping moustache, and surrounded by several beautiful handmaidens. And there the dream ended. It seems to me that dreams can be interpreted in many different ways according to the dreamer. As Dwayne has often said to me, it's your dream. If this dream was intended as a message, and in view of its effect on me, I can only assume this to be the case, although it was so long ago. And yet I have never forgotten it. Then what did it mean? At the time of dreaming, I probably did not get it at all. But it seems to me that it doesn't matter how long ago dreams took place. They are basically stockpiled in your memory until the time comes when you can figure them out. This falls in line with the years of odd experiences I had from early childhood. That's only made sense much later, as a teenager, when I began to twig what it was all about. That is, that I had clearly lived before. Looking again at this particular dream, to me, the obvious conclusion is that the posters signified different lives, if only I had been able to read them. The madcap journey was a fast forward through lives already lived and perhaps some yet to come, the final goal being the extreme contrast of the peace and sincerity of the real universes at the end of it all. Coming forward to the present time, I will conclude this essay with a fairly recent dream. May 2019, in fact. One I ran past Dwayne on one of Kevin's UK Skype sessions. I seemed to be in a large room, which contained only as far as I could see an elderly man in a single bed. I appeared to be in a hospital. Evidently, I had come to visit him. There was nobody else in sight. It appeared, in fact, that nobody came to visit him except me, and I had apparently visited him regularly for some time, so much so that it was beginning to take its toll on my working. This was all the more odd, as I didn't know who on earth he was, but just felt sorry for him. Then a young woman appeared. I assumed at first she was his daughter, but apparently this was not the case. She appeared on several subsequent visits, but I did not find out who she was. Coming out of the room one evening, we were going down a wide corridor together in total darkness, when a young man in dark clothing with a hood, although it didn't cover his face, jumped out of the darkness in front of me and said, "Boo," or something equally inane, and was taken aback when he received an earful of unprintable abuse back from me. He seemed quite downhearted as he withdrew into the shadows and disappeared. I wished I hadn't been quite so rude, but he had made me jump. It now appeared that the old man had passed on, and for some reason the young woman, who it now transpired was a schoolteacher, wanted me to come to some kind of meeting at her school one day at 10 a.m. Accordingly, I found myself driving to the school in what I now knew was Luton, the large town I had been born and raised in, some 14 to 15 miles away from where we now live. I know most of Luton pretty well. I had lived there until I was 27 when I got married. Yet in the dream, I suddenly seemed lost, or at least could not remember the way to the street where the school was. Oddly, the large main road I was driving down was deserted, in fact totally devoid of any vehicles, human or mechanical, moving or stationary. I noticed the road and the pavements, sidewalks, were turning white with a fine layer of powdery snow. I was driving my present car, which I had only then had for some 11 months, so it appeared to be in the present time. Suddenly I could see the woman in a large, sunny, well-lit room with her apparent headmistress sitting either side of a large desk. I was still driving. It was now 10 a.m. and I apologised for the fact I was going to be late and mentioned in passing the snow. Neither of us appeared to have telephones, cameras, or any other device that could explain how we managed to see each other or converse in this manner. A voice, possibly the headmistress's, said, "What snow? It's not snowing here at all." In the meantime, the teacher had stood up and left the room, saying there was no point in waiting here, and she would be back later. That was basically the end of the dream. Having mulled it all over, I put some suggestions to Dwayne. He agreed my suspicion that the teacher was very likely one of the real guides. I had not realised it, but falling snow apparently is a metaphor for the real side, and the fact that nobody else in the dream could see it, although the guide obviously could, was confirmation that I was on a different wavelength to others, hence presumably also the deserted street. I mentioned in my summing up to Duane that I had once, perhaps 25 or more years ago, been told by a self-styled clairvoyant that he was getting the message that this life was my last chance to get it right. At the time I had mentally brushed it aside, but in the light of what is happening now in the world and the apparent narrow time slot to take on the new you, maybe he had been right. Duane said he knew there were many clairvoyants and similar who had genuine knowledge and who got it up to a point, but only up to a point. I also mentioned that I wondered if the guide was indicating to me that I needed to pull my socks up and maybe they were getting tired of waiting for me to. I felt I had lived for thousands of years on Earth. I had had past life sessions going back to as far as ancient Babylon 2,000 to 3,000 years ago and felt extremely world weary. Duane did not come back on this, but I guess he felt that was for me to decide. Right, okay, well, thanks for listening. I'll hopefully be back with episode 6 in my series of essays in the fairly near future. In the meantime, just remains to sing the new you. New you.